Okay, so this is biodiversity lecture number three. We're going to talk about the prokaryotes, and they are the most successful organisms on Earth. We're going to start off by comparing them to eukaryotes, but first of all, let's do a derivation of their name. I'm going to be doing this all year. I'm going to be giving you Greek and Latin roots, and hopefully by the end of the year, you're going to know a lot of them. Pro is the root that means before, and karyo means nucleus. So if you put those together, prokaryote is an organism that existed before the nucleus evolved. Kind of cool, huh? So the word actually means something. And the prokaryotes will include all the domain bacteria and archaea. All those are prokaryotes. Characteristics of the prokaryotes are that they have no nucleus, and they have no organelles at all. Organelles are, it means little organs, and it includes things like the endoplasmic reticulum, the mitochondria, the Golgi bodies, and so on and so forth. We'll talk more about those later, but these guys don't have them. The primary genetic material is surprising to some students. It's one large circular piece of DNA. It's kind of like a big hula hoop, you know? That's what it is. And in addition, they have some secondary genetic material, which are also circular, but much smaller. And these are called plasmids. And they'll be found sort of somewhere in the cell. Another characteristic is they have cell walls. Now, anything that is a cell has a cell membrane. And the cell membrane is that lipid bilayer that you all know about. But in addition, the prokaryotes have a cell wall, which is outside of the cell membrane. And just to let you know, prokaryotes aren't the only group that have a cell wall. There's two other kingdoms that have cell walls. The plants have cell walls, and the fungi have cell walls. So of the five kingdoms that we've learned about, three of them have cell walls: prokaryotes, plants, and fungi. But their cell walls are very different from one another, okay? But they are in addition to the cell membrane. So the way you should think about it is anything that is a cell or anything that has cells, anything that's living, has a cell membrane, which is a lipid bilayer. And three kingdoms have an additional structure outside that cell membrane, which are called cell walls. Okay. The eukaryotes, if we look at their name, eu is the Greek root good or true, and once again, karyo is nucleus. So a eukaryote is an organism with a true nucleus. All other organisms other than bacteria or archaea are eukaryotes, okay? Characteristics, first of all, obviously they have a nucleus, which is an organelle, and they have all the other organelles like mitochondria, endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi bodies, and so forth. Their DNA is not circular, it's linear, so they come in chromosomes, like, you know, we have 23 pairs of chromosomes, right? They're linear. And the amount of genetic material is quite a bit different. It turns out that eukaryotes have about 1,000 times as much DNA as prokaryotes. In fact, this can even vary within the eukaryotes, and this is just kind of a ballpark figure. When we get into genetics, I'll talk more about the amount of genetic material in different organisms. The size is considerably different, too, and this always surprises students. If you look at my illustration here, you'll see where it's labeled cells, and you can see there's two arrows, one pointing to the upper left, and there's kind of a big cell, and then lower right, a smaller cell. Both of those are cells. Those are eukaryotic cells. The bacteria, which is labeled, you know, in red, is pointing to a little black dot. That's a bacteria. So you can see the dramatic size difference. It's remarkable how small bacteria are compared to your prokaryotes are versus eukaryotes. So they can be anywhere, you know, eukaryotes can be 10 to 100 times bigger in size than prokaryotes. And that's really dramatic, and I want you to just get that, because a lot of students, you know, think, oh, you know, a paramecium, an amoeba, a bacteria, they're all single cells, they're all kind of the same size. No way. Big, big difference, okay? The evolutionary relationships are interesting as well. On this next slide, you can see that there was a universal ancestor at some time, you know, let's say about 3.8 billion years ago, and that is in the, they were in the domain bacteria. So the bacteria are the first ones to evolve. And then later came the archaea, and then later still came the eukarya. So that's kind of the order that the evolution occurred. We're not putting firm dates on this yet. Later in the week, when we get to some further lectures, I'll actually start putting some dates. You know, obviously, I told you that we think life emerged somewhere around 3.8 billion years ago, but the other dates we'll save for later. Just wanted to show you the evolutionary relationships. Okay, prokaryotes and their outer container. Well, first of all, like I said, all prokaryotes, like all living things, have a cell membrane. It's also called a plasma membrane. It's simply a lipid bilayer. But they also have cell walls. And like I mentioned, it's unique to prokaryotes. This particular cell wall, there, like I said, there are cell walls around fungi and plants, but they're different materials. The material that surrounds bacteria is this stuff called peptidoglycan. It kind of rolls right off the tongue. I'd like you to repeat that for me. Peptidoglycan. One more time. Peptidoglycan. Okay, very good. And peptidoglycan is made from a mixture of polysaccharides, which are sugars, carbohydrates, and polypeptides, or proteins. And it turns out that bacteria themselves can have different kinds of cell walls. And there was a guy by the name of Graham. He was a biologist that lived, you know, maybe, you know, some sort of between, you know, from 18 something to 19 something, so sort of in that period of time, about 100 years ago. And he used different stains on bacteria, and he found that some bacteria took the stain, this particular stain he was using, and these other bacteria didn't. And so the ones that did were called gram positive because they took the stain, and the ones that didn't were called gram negative. They didn't because, you know, his name's Graham, so he named it after himself. And it turns out that what's interesting is that what causes this is the difference in cell wall. So the peptidoglycan cell wall is different in both these, you know, different groups of bacteria. And what's important for us is that it turns out that antibiotics, which are the drugs that we use to kill bacteria, they actually work in some cases by destroying the cell wall. So you have to use the right antibiotic with the right bacteria. So if you go to the doctor and you have an infection, they'll sometimes try to figure out what kind of group of bacteria it is, if it's a gram negative or gram positive, and depending on which, they'll give you a particular antibiotic that's specific for that kind of bacteria. So that's kind of neat to know. Some bacteria have even another structure on the outside called a capsule, which is a sticky coat. It'll add some protection and also cause the bacteria to be able to stick to surfaces. So all bacteria have a cell membrane, which is then surrounded by a cell wall. All bacteria have that. And then some bacteria have, in addition, one more can, you know, sort of outward, you know, outer container called a capsule. Okay, can prokaryotes move? Well, yeah, they can. How do they move? Using a structure called a flagella. And flagella comes from the Latin word, you know, flagell, you know, we get the word flagellate from it, which means to whip, and it's a Latin root. And so these things are structures that kind of whip around, and by doing that, they are able to move the bacteria. And it turns out that about half the species are able to move this way. And then, of course, we want to know, well, how do they know which way to go? And they have a what's called taxis. And the word taxis is simply this ability of an organism to move towards or away from a stimulus. And so it turns out, if you move towards, it's positive. If it's negative, if it's positive taxis, it's towards. If it's negative taxis, it's away. Chemotaxis simply means either movement towards or away from some kind of chemical stimuli. For example, let's say there's sugar in the environment. Because that's a source of energy, the bacteria would exhibit positive chemotaxis. In other words, they would go towards the sugar. Maybe there's something nasty in the environment, like chlorine, you know, which kills bacteria, right? And they would experience negative chemotaxis. They would want to go away. They'd try to swim away from that. Phototaxis. What do you think phototaxis refers to? Yeah, good. Towards or away from light. And obviously, light's very important. We'll see later in this lecture. Magnetotaxis is movement towards or away from a magnetic stimuli. And what it really means is orientation within a magnetic field. And it turns out the bacteria can actually orient, some can orient within the Earth's magnetic field. Very, very interesting. Okay? Well, let's look at the cellular and genomic organization of prokaryotes. First of all, we know that they don't have organelles. So there are no internal compartments like eukaryotes have at all. The DNA itself is not organized into a nucleus because a nucleus is an organelle, but it is found in a region called the nucleoid. So it's kind of a region of the cell, and that's where the DNA, the main circular piece of DNA is located. Remember that there are these additional smaller pieces of circular DNA called plasmids. They're not found in the nucleoid. They're found in other parts of the cell. And just as a note, these plasmids only contain a few genes. And in fact, some of these genes often confer antibiotic resistance to the organism, which is handy for the organism, not so good for us, especially if we have a bacteria that is infecting us that has this antibiotic resistance, because then it's hard to kill. And one of the things we're going to talk about in the next slide is that this genetic material can actually be transferred during sexual encounters between bacteria. And so that brings us into prokaryotic reproduction. And how do they reproduce? Well, basically asexually, you know, through what's called binary fission, right? One bacterium becomes two bacteria. They just, you know, split apart. And when a bacteria does that, it duplicates all of its DNA, and then the DNA separates into either part of the cell, and then the cell just goes through a process of fission, and now you've got basically two identical bacteria, and if it does it again, two more, and so on and so forth. So all the bacteria are clones of one another, and the only time they differ is if there's some kind of genetic mutation along the way. But generally, if you have a petri dish and you've got a little bacterial colony that's derived from like one original bacteria, then they're all going to be the same. They're all clones of one another. Well, the question on everyone's mind is, do they ever have sex? Okay? Well, not exactly. It depends on how you define sex. If you define sex as mixing up the genetic material, they actually have three ways of having sex. One of them is transformation, and you actually did this in a lab in your previous bio class. Do you remember the P-glow? Do you remember the jellyfish gene that glows in ultraviolet light? Do you guys remember that lab? That was a transformation lab. And transformation is kind of weird if you think about it. The bacteria can actually take in DNA that's floating around in the environment. It can actually move it right through the cell wall, through the cell membrane, bring it into its cell, and then incorporate it into its own DNA, which is amazing, and that's called transformation. There's another process of sex, I guess, in bacteria called conjugation, and this is where two bacteria come up next to one another, and they form a structure between them, like a tube between them called a pili, and then once they form that tube, parts of the plasmid or parts of even the bacterial chromosome can move through that pili and go to the other bacteria, and therefore they're exchanging genetic material, hence there's bacterial sex. The final way they have sex is that I won't even call it an organism, because it's not really an organism. You know, are viruses alive or dead? That's a big debatable subject, but whatever you want to consider viruses, they can be what's called a vector, where they move some genetic material, some DNA from one bacteria to another bacteria. And it's a process called transduction. And so what they essentially do is the viruses will sort of attach to a bacteria, inject their DNA into the bacteria, and then what they do is they kind of wreak havoc with the bacteria, and sometimes they inadvertently will take a little bit of the bacterial chromosome and incorporate it in their own DNA, and they'll make a new virus that now has the original viral DNA and some of the bacterial DNA. Then they'll kill the bacteria by exploding it, and out come all the viruses, and now they'll infect another bacteria and in turn mix some of their, could be some of the viral DNA and some of that other bacterial DNA in with the new bacterial DNA, and that's how it gets transferred between bacteria. Yeah. It's really literally the cell membrane goes out and connects with the other. So yeah, it's just a cell membrane that forms a tube. Yeah, it's crazy. Okay, let's talk about nutrition. There's two things all organisms need to live. They need energy to do work, and they need carbon, because carbon provides the basic structure of all living things. It's like, you know, if you have a brick building, it's like the bricks. You may have not thought of nutrition like this before, but this is really the way you need to think about it. And I want to say, I think I've got maybe a total of 4 slides on this. This will be the first one. There's 3 more after this. These are very important slides to study and know, because the College Board loves to test on nutritional, all these different forms of nutrition. So you might want to put stars and circles and arrows in this part of the lecture and really study it well, because you will need to know this on my quiz, on my test, and definitely the College Board exam in May. So what's nutrition? It's simply how organisms obtain these two resources. And it turns out that there's 4 different ways for organisms to get energy and carbon. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a slide, and when we're done with this slide, we're going to pick one from the left column and one from the right column, and then we'll create the 4 different types. We've got photoautotrophs. The word photo refers to light. Troph refers to feeder. And so these are organisms that get energy from light. Chemotrophs, chem refers to chemical, troph, feeder. These are organisms that get energy from chemicals. Now, obtaining carbon, autotrophs. And auto refers to self, troph, feeder. These are organisms that get carbon from CO2. Now, before I go on, let's just do a little exploration of the word auto, because we all drive automobiles, right? And so I want you to think about that for a minute. How did the word, where do we get the word automobile from? Why is it called an automobile? Yeah. Okay, it's something that you drive yourself, okay? Now, where do you think the historical derivation of that is from? Yeah. Exactly. Before the automobile, anything that, you know, like a little structure that you were in was always pulled by something outside of that structure. So there was a horse, like pulling a little carriage or something, right? Well, when the automobile was invented, they basically said, here we are in our little carriage, but we don't need the horses anymore. There's something in this little thing that causes it to go by itself. So that's why they gave the automobile its name. Automobiles, kind of neat. I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but now that you know the root, it makes sense. Okay, heterotroph. Hetero means other, troph means feeder. And these are organisms that get carbon from a source other than CO2. Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to mix and match these, one from the left, one from the right, and we're going to come up with 4 different ways that organisms get carbon and energy. First of all, let's look at autotrophs. These are self-feeders, and they don't need other organisms for carbon. photoautotrophs. They use light as an energy source. They use CO2 as a carbon source. And examples, obviously, we all know, plants. Okay? Also, all photosynthetic prokaryotes are photoautotrophs. Now, the most famous of these is the cyanobacteria, okay, which is sometimes improperly named in books blue-green algae. Get that out of your mind. If you see, you know, if you see a reference to blue-green algae, it's not algae. It's really cyanobacteria. It's a prokaryote. So this is a misnomer that's been perpetrated in lots of bio books, but it's really a prokaryote. It's really, you know, one of the first, one of the early prokaryotes, okay, able to photosynthesize. Chemoautotrophs. These guys use inorganic chemicals as an energy source. It's kind of different. They use hydrogen sulfide, iron, you know, ions of iron. It's kind of crazy. And they use CO2 as a carbon source. Examples, there are some archaea that live in these things called hydrothermal vents. And if you think about it, if you go in the ocean and you drop down about 200-300 feet, eventually you come to just complete and utter darkness. There's no light down there, right? And if that's true, then you can't, you know, how do you get energy? Well, the only way to get energy, if you're below about 300 feet in the ocean, either photosynthesis is going on at the surface, and then, you know, so something's capturing energy from the sun, and then it rains down, right? That's one way. Or you've got to find an energy source down in the abyss. And it turns out that in the late 1970s, they discovered these things called hydrothermal vents, which are coming up. Usually they're found where plate boundaries are. And hydrogen sulfide is usually the main chemical that comes up, and it's full of energy. And organisms have actually figured out, they've evolved, to be able to extract the energy from the hydrogen sulfide and live. And so all they need is hydrogen sulfide. That's their energy source. It's not sunlight. It's hydrogen sulfide. So it's kind of crazy. The very first hydrothermal vents were actually discovered right off the Galapagos Islands, which are off the coast of South America. And then now they found them all over the world now. And, you know, it's kind of neat to just, you can go on websites and read all about these and see pictures of them and all these crazy organisms that live down there. Okay, photoheterotrophs. They use light as an energy source. They use organic molecules as a carbon source. They're not so common, so I'm not going to really get into them. Chemoheterotrophs. They use organic molecules as an energy source, like sugar. They use organic molecules as a carbon source, like protein, sugars, fats, nucleic acids, and so forth. And it turns out to be the most common form of nutrition on Earth. And it's used in most prokaryotes, protists, fungi, and animals. So we are all chemoheterotrophs. You look around the room and you're looking at a bunch of chemoheterotrophs. Back tonight, go home and tell your parents what they are. Just, you know, look at them and go, you chemoheterotroph. See what they say. Then you can explain it to them. This following slide is sort of a summary from your book of the different modes of nutrition, and I recommend you just memorize this. You need to know it. The College Board is going to expect it. I'm going to expect it. You got to know it backwards, forwards, inside and out. Just know it, okay? But the one thing I want to do so you don't lose the forest for the trees is to realize that the two most common forms of nutrition are either photoautotroph, which, you know, basically, you know, plants and photosynthetic prokaryotes, and then chemoheterotrophs, things that eat other organisms for energy and carbon, like us. Okay, like I mentioned, chemoheterotrophs are the most common nutritional form in prokaryotes, and if you sort of subdivide these into two kind of special ways they work, one is what are called saprobes, otherwise known as decomposers, and these are organisms that get their nutrition from dead organisms. So anything that eats a dead organism is a saprobe, and prokaryotes love to do this. And we're really thankful, because if prokaryotes weren't around doing this, then all this organic material, all this living material, when it dies, would just be piling up on the planet. And we'd be, you know, miles deep in dead organic material. But thank goodness for prokaryotes, because 24/7 for billions of years, they've been eating dead stuff and breaking it down, and, you know, just breaking it down completely. You know, fungi are also another group that do this as well, but prokaryotes are, they've been doing it for forever. They're also parasites, and parasites are organisms that get their energy and carbon from living organisms, okay? Now, let me talk about the nitrogen problem. The reason there's a nitrogen problem is because, first of all living organisms need nitrogen, and nitrogen is found, remember I talked about the four different organic molecules yesterday? Proteins, right? Carbohydrates, fats, and nucleic acids. Of those four groups, two of them, proteins and nucleic acids, have nitrogen in them. Since they have nitrogen, we have to have nitrogen somehow. We have to get it. Organisms need to get it. And the problem is, even though there's lots of nitrogen around, like every breath you take, your 80% of what's going into your lungs is N2. It's nitrogen. But the problem is, almost all organisms on the planet have no way of breaking that nitrogen down and making it usable. It stays as N2. That's it. The solution has been that some prokaryotes have evolved the ability to take this unusable N2 and convert it into ammonia or other forms that are maybe less nasty, that organisms can then use and incorporate the nitrogen into their bodies. And this process of converting N2 into some kind of usable form of nitrogen is called nitrogen fixation. And there's a wonderful symbiotic relationship between plants and prokaryotes. It turns out that one group of plants called legumes, which include peas and beans and alfalfa, they have little nodules on their roots. And in these nodules, there are a group of prokaryotes that live that can actually take atmospheric nitrogen and convert it into ammonia or some usable form of nitrogen that the plant can use. So you can plant a legume in what, you know, is considered not very fertile soil, and it's completely happy because it doesn't need to have any fertilizer, because it just sits there and the prokaryotes in its root nodules are converting atmospheric nitrogen into the nitrogen that it needs. And then in return, what it does is it converts sunlight into sugar and it feeds the bacteria. So there, it's what we call a mutualistic relationship. They help one another. Super important relationship. Okay. It turns out that oxygen is a really interesting little molecule. So oxygen is required for life. And if you're an organism that is requiring oxygen, we call you an obligate aerobe. And obligate is from oblige, you're bound or compelled to. Aerobe is oxygen or air. And so obligate aerobes require oxygen to live. There are organisms that are poisoned by oxygen, and they're called obligate anaerobes. Remember the word, the prefix an means no or not. And these organisms cannot experience oxygen. If they experience oxygen, they will die immediately. And an example of this from the domain Archaea is the methanogens. And what they do is they convert CO2 to methane, and they're found in several places. They're found in the GI tracts of animals because there's no oxygen there, and they make methane. They're found in swamps or marshes and underneath the mud where the oxygen can't get, in sewer treatment facilities, and they will convert CO2 to methane. And they can have oxygen, but they do exist on Earth, sort of in places where oxygen isn't found. There is also a condition under which you can have oxygen or you can not have oxygen. It's either way. And these are called facultative anaerobes. And so in a facultative anaerobe, facultative means not required, you know, it's not or compulsory, it's optional. In other words, these organisms, If there's oxygen around, they're happy to use oxygen. If there's no oxygen, they don't need it. They don't care. Let me tell you about the oxygen revolution. When the Earth was formed 4.5 billion years ago, there was no oxygen. Life emerged around 3.8 billion years ago in an anaerobic environment. Therefore, all the original prokaryotes were obligate anaerobes. Kind of interesting. So somewhere between 3.4 and 2.5 billion years ago, cyanobacteria evolve. They're able to photosynthesize, and as a result, they produce oxygen as a byproduct. And what happens is oxygen begins to build up in the environment. Well, in the early time, you know, in the Earth, things were living in water, right? They weren't living on land. So these cyanobacteria are living in the oceans, and they're producing oxygen, so the amount of oxygen in the oceans is building up. The first thing that happens is oxygen oxidizes the iron in the ocean and basically forms rust. And we have evidence of this between 3.4 and 2.5 billion years ago in what are called the banded iron formations that are pictured here. And we can see them in marine sediments. And it's really ancient rust. And so we know that that's when oxygen started to be produced. It's very cool. It's one of the coolest paleontological finds that, you know, that I just think is so neat that the scientists figured this out. Well, what happens as a result of the oxygen revolution? Once all the iron in the oceans and on the land was oxidized, the oxygen concentration increases in the oceans, the oxygen concentration increases in the atmosphere, and now the obligate anaerobic bacteria become marginalized because basically oceans and the terrestrial environment are full of poison, oxygen. So they have nowhere to run. They have nowhere to hide. Well, not exactly. They just have to search for places without oxygen. And so what happens is obligate aerobic bacteria begin to evolve, and that's the continuation of our story. And so the question is, well, who do we thank for the creation of our oxygen-rich environment? Who do we thank? You got it, cyanobacteria. They're the ones that created our oxygen-rich environment, and now we have other organisms that help us, help to contribute to this as well. But they're the ones that started the oxygen revolution. And what's funny is the original prokaryotes that could only live in an anaerobic environment, they were the main player in the beginning of the evolution of life. Now, the only place we can find them are in these marginalized places in the world, like in swamps, in the GI tract of animals, and wherever they're only found in places where oxygen isn't. It's very interesting. So the rulers of the earth are now like just hiding away in these places, and cyanobacteria and aerobic organisms evolved after that. So things switch around. Just like the dinosaurs ruled the Earth at one time, and then at 65 million years ago, right, an asteroid hit, and now the dinosaurs are gone, and we're here, and all these mammals. So it's interesting how things change through time. Okay, quiz tomorrow on this material. See you then.